My guest today will impress you so much with his adventures that you will sit on the edge of your seat and go, really? He's going to do that? Oh, he's already done that. Wow, that is epic. I'm so glad that he actually had some time today and I got to speak to him on a beautiful, bright sunshine day, which is kind of rare because the adventure sports that this man is up to is oftentimes contingent on whether there's a good window of weather, and today there happens to be, so I'm sure that as soon as this interview is over, he'll be out the door. Today we're going to talk about paragliding and also motorcycle riding at minus 30, minus 40, and all the other adventures that this man has been up to that have happened in Yukon and also around the world. So without further ado, let's cue the music and we will get right to it. Here we go.
Welcome to My Amazing Yukon Life Podcast. It's time now to sit back and fill your gold poke with nuggets of knowledge as we pan through stories of desperate struggle, wild adventure, love, despair, and untold fortune, recounted by those with the tenacity, determination, and grit to survive and thrive amidst the magic and mystery of Canada's Yukon. And now, your host, affectionately known as Trapper Dan, Yukon's Renaissance man, Daniel Haley.
Welcome, everyone, to My Amazing Yukon Life podcast number 12. Today, keeping in the theme of aviation, I have a friend on board here who has a lot of experience in something that I have yet to try but am extremely interested in doing. His name is Voschen, and he is a paraglider and an adventurist, to say the least. So without further ado, let's talk to this man. Hey, thanks for meeting with me. I know you're busy. We've been trying to hook up for a while, and in keeping with the theme of the 100th anniversary of Yukon Aviation, I thought you would be like one of the guys that's definitely on my bucket list to get an interview with. So I'm surprised to catch you actually on a clear day, because it's not too windy out, and this is probably pulling at your heartstrings to get up in the air right now, isn't it?
Yes, it is actually. It would be perfect day for paramotoring today.
Yeah,
because the wind, there's almost no wind, and yeah.
Yeah, that looks absolutely gorgeous out here. Oh, and incidentally, a guide happened to like physically drop into my place last week. Some friends of mine were having a barbecue in the front field, and in comes this paraglider. Well, what did you call it? It's not paragliding with the propeller. What is that term called?
Paramotoring.
Paramotoring.
Yeah, paramotor.
Yeah, he came and landed, and it's like, wow, okay. I have to get a hold of Voschen like right now because I need to know more about this. So let's get you introduced here. Like, first of all, everyone's got a story why we came to the Yukon, and I'm sure you have one as well too. So let's start with that. What brought you here, especially to Whitehorse?
Well, in 2008, I started traveling around the world on my motorcycle. That's a trip that I never really finished to the end yet, but it's still in project.
Right.
And in 2011, I was basically traveling through Yukon and going to Alaska, explored Alaska, and on the way back, on my way to South America, I stopped here in Whitehorse, and I met a Croatian guy, because I'm from Slovenia. Mm-hmm. And Croatia is the southern country for mine. And then I met this guy, and he invited me to his place. And I just mentioned him, oh, yeah, once in a while I look for the work. And, then I can make some money, and then I keep going, you know. And then, yeah, he invited me to his place, and he said, oh, this is the place you should definitely work. And you can make good money, and you can go anytime. Mm-hmm. But, the story, like lots of other people have, they come here for a week or two and they never leave, you know? And this is basically what happened to me.
Yeah.
I go here.
Yeah, that's such a common theme. I know I had the same idea. I came up for a year and 25 years later, still here. So welcome to, welcome to Yukon, my friend.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. So you say you're from Slovenia. Is there a lot of people doing the kind of sports that you do there when you were a child?
Yes.
Is there?
Yeah. Slovenia is, people are very involved in sports with like lots of different sports. What I do, yeah, paragliding, it's a it's a very famous sport, especially in my area, because actually where I live, we have a mountain of altitude 1,200 meters. And in a nice day, there can be 100 to even up to 200 paragliders up in the air. And but the weird thing is, I actually never tried this sport at home. I actually learned everything up here in Yukon.
Is that right? So you came up on a motorcycle, and did you see someone here doing it, or how did you get involved here?
Not really. I basically started paragliding because, when I start traveling with my motorcycle, you know, I do photography and videos and stuff like that, and then I always want to do a little bit different things than other people, and the only way to take a different photos, different videos, it's from the air actually.
Right.
And then I was looking to basically invest in a big drone, or I will start flying, and because you don't really experience.
Right.
When you don't really, you know, you take a shot with a drone, but you didn't really saw this photo with your own eyes, and then you didn't really experience it. Then it doesn't really have the same story, you know?
Right.
And that's why I decide to paraglide.
Oh, that's hilarious! So you're the life size drone, basically.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Do you do the same with your motorcycle too? Do you have some kind of technology on that for getting video?
I just use, you know, GoPros and stuff on a bike, but everybody does this, you know. It's kind of start getting a little bit boring, you know, just
right.
It is cool, like when I drive on ice roads on ice and stuff like this, where actually nobody really does those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
It's more cool, but otherwise, you know, I think videos and photos are always taken from the same angle over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And I think up from the air, it's just more like magic and beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a perspective that, you know, no one's going to see really, unless you're part of it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And also just you know, just the feeling of flying and to be like a bird. It's an awesome feeling.
Oh, I can imagine. So when you came here, did you see somebody doing this, or what was your first introduction then?
No, not really. I just I actually never really saw up here people flying, or maybe didn't never really pay attention to it. It was just a choice of mine to basically start doing this. And as soon as I started to dig in deeply in, I found out there is actually quite a bit of pilots up here.
Mm-hmm.
And I connect with them, and I connect with Trevor, who was my instructor, and actually I was his first student.
Oh, is that right? That's Trevor Mead Robbins, is it?
Yes, exactly. Yes. Yeah.
Oh, interesting. So yeah. Do you get certified by him as a pilot yourself, or how does your certification work?
Yes. I basically before I even start flying, I actually bought all the equipment without much of a knowledge of flying, because I was so determined that I want to do this, and I just actually bought everything before.
Right.
And when I was researching where to you know, learn how to fly, I came across Trevor, and I was advised to first learn how to free fly. It was actually a very, very important choice. And then I connect with Trevor, and basically I first learned how to free fly, did all the certifications, and also all the insurances, you know, because we have a HVAC, we have the insurance for certain sites where we are covered if something happened, or if we make some damage to somebody around, you know.
Okay.
But yeah, this was definitely a very, very important decision, you know, to first free fly, because with free flying you get way more knowledge about wind, you know, the weather and weather conditions, even the surrounding way. Were you actually flying? No,
right.
Yeah, it was the most important choice, I think.
Well, that's interesting, because my guest last week, Uli, he wants to start the Yukon Gliders Association here. And he was advised early in life to become a glider pilot first before becoming a full engine certified pilot. And that's when he was, that was his sentiments exactly. Like, this is important because you understand all the, like, the aspects of thermals and, you know, descent rates and whatnot. So is there a lot of ground schooling involved with this then too, before you actually strap on one of these? And...
Yes. Well, the very, very important part is actually kiting. Then you are actually able to launch when you're up in the mountain, because you never know how it's going to be wind. You know, you have to train yourself with launching, you know, forward or reverse. You know, depends on wind speed and conditions, and also the slope you're taking off. You know, because as you know, Yukon, it's very we have quite interesting ground, no nature. Sometimes can be you can have really like very, very small place to take off, and they can be like full of willows and sharp rocks and stuff like that, and you have to actually nail it in like you have to be perfect on it, and that's why it's very important. And you do lots of ground handling, you learn your kiting really well.
Okay. So do you have, you said there's insurance that goes with this. Is this through some association? Like, does Yukon have an association for paragliders?
We have a club in Yukon, but this insurance HPAC, it's actually for the whole Canada. Every single paraglider who wants to fly on all the sites that are covered by HPAC, they must have this insurance, and you must have the certification P2, because there's a P1, P2, P3, P4, no? Okay. Minimum P2, then you can fly on your own.
What is that? Yeah. What does that P1 through 4 stand for exactly?
Basically, P1, it's a student, no, who is still under an instructor, and when he passed his exam P2, basically he can fly on his own.
Okay.
There's most of people that I know, they actually have P2, P3. Even myself, I went to P only to P2, because to me the most important is just to get the knowledge, you know, like a flying and doing just to get as much as experience as possible, you know, up in the air.
Is your license based on time in the air, as it is with like a traditional pilot?
To get to P3, you have to have around 200 flights, but I have way more than that already. Then it basically, you just had for each of those certifications, you have to achieve so many flights, and you know, you have to demonstrate different maneuvers and stuff.
When you're doing your test or your certification, how do they monitor this? Does another person come up with you on another shoot and just come along?
No. Usually, he's always with you on the radio. And there's usually somebody also helping sometimes, but you know, he can see exactly what you're doing. He's gonna guide you when you're flying from your start to the landing, because especially in the beginning, you must be able to where you took off, you have to see your landing space. Then it has to be very you can do your visualization properly. You can basically do all your takeoff and approaching and everything. It's visible. And also, when you do those kind of flights, you already have some, you already covered most of those little flights. You already, like, the instructor already knows, then you are capable to doing that, no? And you just have to demonstrate it, and yeah.
Okay.
And after everything else, you know, it just comes with time.
Right. Is there is it pretty costly to do this, to get certified?
Yes and no. Up here in Yukon, Trevor, he's very supportive, and he's doing this I think mostly from his heart, you know. He really loves to teach other people and try to grow this sport a bigger in Yukon. Myself, because I was his first student, we make a deal. Then I was working on all these sites, cleaning them, you know, right, making bigger, where we take off, launching sites. And because up here, like I said before, nature, it's very powerful, and you have to really keep it up with it. And if we want to keep our sites nice and clean, there is a lot of work involved too.
Mm-hmm. You're not just restricted to summer here either. I've seen some video of you actually on your Facebook page taking off on the ski hill, right, at Dan's Descent in the winter.
Any time of year. We fly anytime. The only thing, you know, winter, we don't really have thermals. No, we can't really go really high up. We can do ridge soaring. This is where we can stay for a really long time. It is ridge soaring was one of longest flights that I had here. It was almost 3 hours at a golf course.
Is that right?
In a whistle band, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. When the air, it's perfect magic, you just fly, you know, stay up and you don't go down. And even if you're cold, because it was around minus 20, I think, but I dressed really well. I'm already used to driving my motorcycle in the winter too. Then I dress in the same way, and the mm-hmm. temperature is not really a problem, no, to stay up for then.
Mm-hmm.
But I fly sometimes with skis. I try also when it's really, really cold, and when we get sometimes minus 40, that's another motivation. Then I will go out and make a flight, you know.
Is that right?
just to do an experience. But when it's minus 40, usually you don't really fly minus 40, because when you hike up the mountain, the inversion, it's a big difference. You know? Usually it's about 15 degrees change, and you basically land into the minus 40. You know?
So let me get my head around this. It's minus 20-ish or colder. You hop on your motorcycle with your...
Yeah.
And you head up the mountain. That is so hardcore. I actually just love that. It's the thought of that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's usually actually, yeah, I normally drive my motorcycle like every winter. I go skiing, I go flying, I take everything on the bike.
Mm-hmm.
you know.
So what do you have for a motorcycle? Just a little of an aside. It must be something specced for winter.
I have a BMW GS 1200 Adventure. I actually own two of them. I have one that I came from Europe with, and I was traveling, and then I have one that I got here, the one that I'm basically driving right now. They are basically boxers, really good machines, reliable machines.
Mm-hmm.
They can basically run in any temperatures. They are awesome bikes.
So the boxer is like an opposing four cylinder, isn't it?
Or yes,
two cylinder, a four cylinder. Okay.
No, it's a four cylinder.
Four. And what about the clutch system and all that too? Is it?
Well, that's a really good question, and it's actually the most important thing on this bike. It's actually the clutch system. The 1200 GS all the way to 2014 or 15, I think, they still have the dry clutch.
Okay, that's why it works at that temperature then.
Yeah,
okay.
Exactly, yeah. I can basically use any temperature, any oil I want, because specifically for the motorcycle, finding 040 with a wet clutch, it's really hard, you know. That's why the bike I can run it, and I also install on the bike like an oil heater and the battery heaters and all this stuff. Then when I really get in really really cold temperatures, I can plug the bike, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But also have a system that I can cover the bike and put the burners underneath to warm up enough the everything, and then I can actually ride my motorcycle. Yeah.
So how do you pack all your gear into the bike? Do you have a panniers on it or something?
Usually, well, just when I drive here around, especially for the on my flying gear and skis, I just mount them on the side because the bike is quite big and quite large. Mm-hmm. It's easy to put on. And my paraglider, I just put him on the back in a stuff bag. It's just a big bag that we put in really quick. Because I'm not really driving too far away, on like about what 15K from my place to Skill Hill. But when I go for the longer roads, I pack more official. You know? Mm-hmm. But the good thing is also now with the paragliders, they used to be big and heavy, but the technology changed so much too. Then we can pack them really small. In the harnesses and everything, and it can actually fit in a really small backpack. You know?
Okay. Is there a difference between like seasonal kites? I don't know if that's a legit question, but is there some kind of differing material?
No. Yeah, basically, paragliders they really evolved in the last few years. Now most of like lots of people start buying those very famous wings. We call them hike and fly. They are made out of very light material, and they are just they are way more efficient, and then like they have way better gliding ratios and stuff, and they are way more stable and safer, easier to launch. It's a huge difference. The one that I was learning on, it was like from 2000, I would say, I think it was 8, something like this. Right. And just to launch this wing, I had to pull it so hard. And when I got the new one, I just used 2 fingers and I overshoot it because it was just so easy to bring it up. You know? Right. When you used to work hard for, you know, to bring them up, it's hard to adapt your body right away to go to with something much where it's actually much easier, you know, to do it. You know?
Yeah, it's like the difference between driving a big truck or a small little sports car, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. And also the harnesses they are becoming smaller. I mean, not smaller, but smaller in size to pack. Much safer. Mm-hmm. A year and a half ago, I purchased this ultralight pod harness. That's the one harness that you actually sit inside and kind of lay in it, and your legs are covered, mm-hmm. and you basically you're more aerodynamic than any other ones, and they are like the whole harness is only 1.4 kilo, without reserve. It's an extra kilogram there. Okay. And for the protection for your back, it's actually inflatable balloon underneath. No, okay. In the case of the crash, basically it's gonna protect your back, no, and right. your neck and stuff. No,
have you actually been in a situation where you've tested that?
Actually, I just did. Yeah. I just came from we went up to Dawson to the top of the World Highway in Tombstone, flying with few friends up here, mm-hmm. and we were at very close to the border at the top of the World Highway. And then we start fly. Like I was flying like early in the morning, me and Trevor. And the first flight was awesome. He was also having fun and everything. And I went for the second flight on my own. And the wind started changing, getting more gusty. But you know, you cannot see the air. You cannot see what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And I was actually soaring the mountain. And I got really huge gust from other side, from the side a little bit, half of the wing collapsed, and I basically started shooting down towards the huge rocks.
Oh, gee.
And but the good thing, the glider was still flying completely straight, and when I hit down with the balloon, it just popped. It just explode, but balloon didn't balloon didn't explode, just the material all around exploded. It just sheared everything. And it basically bounced me up and turned the glider a little bit towards the mountain. And, you know, the body just did everything. It just, I don't even know how I made it out, but I just grabbed my rear brake and bumped it back, and the wing opened right away. Because I was ready I was ready for the second hit with my head, basically, mm-hmm. and I don't know, magically just opened and I just flew away, and I went straight to landing, and you know, just yelled to everybody, nobody goes up in air, because it's the things are changing, and this is the very important thing that you have to make a right call before you take off, mm-hmm. and if. Changing, and wind is getting weirder. It's better wait. You know, that's why we call it para-waiting.
You know? Para-waiting, but you can't see it. Like I have some experience with sailboats, and you can see when things are coming in, and the weather's getting bad. But you can't see this. So, how do you, if you're up there, how do you predict what your next move is? You probably just want to get on the ground, right?
Yeah, it's actually a good point you pointed sailboat, because actually when we fly close to the water, we actually watch the water, you know, because the water really shows you where is the gust, you know, where the gusts are coming. You know, you can really see. We watch the trees and stuff, the clouds. We always monitor everything around us, try to determine, you know, if it's good, it's not good. Mm-hmm. Or there's always somebody who is a guinea pig, you know, and goes up in air.
Right.
And if it's bad, it just goes down right away. Usually those are more like pioneers, I call them, you know?
Sure, yeah.
The guys, they fly for a really long time. And we always share the knowledge, what we think, you know, and you have to be really careful when you go up in air. And you don't, I always say, if it's not good today, no, it's always tomorrow. No.
Yeah, that's it.
More than today, and it's better walk away than than something else happen. No.
Yeah, some people get just caught up in the sense of urgency that this is the last opportunity, so I'm going to go for it. You know, you go out on a lake,
yes.
You go up in the sky, like that's bad.
Yeah. And it is hard, you know, when you're up in the mountain or even like small hill, and you really want to go fly. Especially this year was so bad. We had such a bad summer and mm-hmm. so much rain and really strong winds. And you have a window and you really want to go up in air, but you know you're right on the edge, you know, and you have to make a right call. And you really want to be up in air because it's, you know, you couldn't fly for a month maybe, you know, mm-hmm. or for a week or. Or maybe you could fly, but you have to work, you know. And you make a bad decision, and you can actually end up really bad, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Then,
mm-hmm.
Even my last accident that I had, you know, if I didn't have this protection at the bottom as the air balloon, I'm 100% sure that today I will be in a wheelchair. You know?
Is that right?
And, yeah. Because it was a big hit, man, and I felt after my back and my neck and stuff, you know, but wow. I was able to walk away, and this is what's the most important for me. You know?
What a valuable piece of equipment that was. That was worth every penny plus more.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. That's why you're never cheap. Also on a very important piece of equipment. You know?
Yeah. Do you have your favorite particular chutes that you use? Like if you're going to a certain area, is there something that you prefer over another?
Well, there are different paragliders out there. You know, they like we have our, I would say, normal. They are like Hike and Fly, basically. Or let's make it more simple. Basically. But paragliders, they are classified A, B, high B, then C and D, and they are one without ratings. Those are basically even the D gliders. They are acro gliders to make many maneuvers. The A gliders are very safe gliders. Basically, they fly slower. They are not so responsive. No, they they just inflate easier. They fly nicer. They won't collapse as fast as other ones. A big glider, it's already a more responsive glider. Mm-hmm. Fly faster, responds better, but still very, very, very safe glider. The sea gliders are already more more advanced. They are more sporty, more. They fly, of course, a little bit faster too. And then after they add the D gliders, they are also those gliders. They use them in the competitions. They are very fast, but they also can collapse quick and stuff. You know, mm-hmm. They are not as stable than other ones, and also the acro gliders. You know, and they are also one without the readings. You know, mm-hmm. because they don't pass the certifications. You know. And on the side on this, they are also mini wings, for the speed flying. They are just much, much smaller wings. They are very stable. They fly very fast, but they are also dangerous if you do some crazy maneuvers and stuff. Because mm-hmm. usually when people start flying those, they want to do some, you know, turns around, acro stuff. And if you make a mistake, you know, you can end up really bad. Mm-hmm. And I never personally try any of those. I know they are fun, but I when I go up in air, I look more for the air time to fly. You know, fly as long as possible, and just enjoy mm-hmm. not doing any crazy maneuvers and stuff. That's not really friendly.
No, well, the peace and quiet of it all, and you know, the ability to get up there with your camera and take pictures of stuff that you'll never see again. That's a huge magnet. I can't understand why you'd want to get on the ground any faster. I think it would all be about staying up as long as you can.
Yeah, the only time when you really want to go down is just when the weather really goes out.
Yeah,
then that's the time when you really want to get down. Mm-hmm.
It sounds to me like you might have a few of these paraglider varieties to choose from of your own. Is that fair to say?
Currently, I own two. One is for free flying, and one is for paramotoring and the free flying too. The one for free flying, it's a sea wing. It's a little bit more advanced, and it's actually from my country, from my town. It's a it's a really, really good glider. I'm very proud to fly something also that's made in my country too. Right now it's one of the best gliders. It has a really good reputation, very safe. I really, really enjoy this glider. My second glider, it's a hybrid. It's basically it can be flown with power motor, and it can be also flown without motor. I got this glider for quite a few years, and actually I was doing all my free flying with this wing too. It's really well built, very strong, really thick lines. It's almost like a tank, flying a tank. It's a very interesting glider because it's actually a reflex glider. It can fly much faster, especially when you have the paramotor on it. You put it when you actually gain certain altitude, you can put in a reflex mode. And if you're flying with wind, I know people, they reach almost I think 105 kilometers an hour. I reached 95. This was my max speed, and I reached with it. But it's a very interesting glider. This one is made in Poland, it's really very, very stable, safe glider. And because it's also hybrid, you can when you get your altitude up in the air with the paramotor, you can shut off the motor, and I can actually thermal. If I get in thermals, I can just use the power of wind and go up, you know, instead of the motor.
That was a question I was going to ask. I was wondering, like, if that stops working, but that's not an issue then, by any means.
No, not at all. If you want to do lots of thermal link with the motor, it's probably a very important part that you choose the right motor too, mm-hmm. because the power motors they are different hooking system. You have the low system and the high system. The high system it's more for like a acro and like more if you want to do some really crazy stuff. You're a little bit more stable in a harness. It's just way better for it. But if you want to do thermaling and stuff, it's better than you hook into the lower system,
right.
Because you can weight shift, you know, on the side, because when you go in a thermal, you always shift a little bit into it, and you know you're always turning it around. Then you always it's just much easier to do that. You know?
Okay. Is there an actual, what's the word I'm looking for? Some kind of maximum speed that you can go to before that kite or the sail will lose its formation? Like I know with the sailboat, there's a hull speed. If it exceeds that hull speed, it gets drawn into the water. Is there something like that that happens to these, the parafoil?
Yes. Well, I mean, usually, it's not going to collapse. No, you'll be still flying. No.
Okay.
I mean, if you really go the minimum, you have to really pull your brakes all the way down, and you basically stall your glider, and this is when it's going to go down. But otherwise, it's going to just glide down. No, mm-hmm. The motor, it doesn't really matter if runs or not. No.
No. Okay.
I mean, it matters because you'll crash. No, but if you're above the trees or stuff like that. No, but it's not really. The motor, it's not important to the power of the motor is not important than for the speed to make a stall and stuff like that. No.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what are some of the places that you've launched from, like some that are notable that you recommend someone to try?
For free flying, we have quite a bit of places here. One, it's like Mount Sima, Heco Hill, the Grey Mountain, the Vista, Jake's Corner, or we also hike on the spots, you know, mountains, and figure out where we can take off and look down, you know, where we can have the landing spot or even emergency landing too, you know, because you have to mm-hmm. always think about that things can go wrong and you have to come down quick, or if something change, you know, and you're going down, then you have to be able to land, because as you know, Yukon has trees everywhere, and we don't really have much open spots where we can safely land without damaging our wing, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, Uli was talking last week about his gliding in North Germany. He said that there is, through his insurance that they had with the clubs, if you landed on a farmer's field and had some crop damage, they would be like reimbursed and that kind of thing. So I guess you're looking for a field too every now and then, like you say, an exit strategy of some sort.
Yes, we do. Usually we look for the roads too, you know, because mm-hmm. like we don't really have so much traffic here, like down south. This is usually our landing spots, emergency stuff. If we really have to, we will land on a road, mm-hmm. On a field too. Like you mentioned, they have in Germany, they have insurance. This is also what our insurance covers, like HVAC too.
Okay.
I believe it's up to 5 million, I think, something like this. And it's not really to cover us. It's to cover damage that we made if we, I don't know, land on a power line, there's a business there, and then we cause damage and stuff. No, okay. This is what they cover. No?
Okay, I get it. So where was your first flight then? Like, that's a pretty bold step to just jump off a mountain. Where did you do your first one?
We have a bunch of spots. We call them bunny hills, no? Where we just when we just have a flight of 10 seconds, 15 seconds, or maybe 20 seconds, no?
Sure, okay.
because then you feel the wind, the air, all those things. And there's a bunch of them around here. I made one, clean one, up to the when you go up to Gray Mountain. Mm-hmm. There's more Bunny Hill up there, and but otherwise, my high first flight was at the Heckle Hill. It's which was from the tower down.
Can you recount that day? Were you nervous, or were you just ready to go at that point?
Yeah. It's I'm always a little bit nervous, because I think to be a little bit nervous, it's a good thing. You know, if you're too confident, if you're too confident, usually you forget something. You know, maybe you don't do the pre-flight check. You know, if everything is strapped, everything is in good, everything is in order. No, that's a very important part. Yeah. To make sure that everything is it's great. But of course, those first flights, you know, you always are nervous. So how's it going to go? How's going to be my landing? Is going to be tree or is going to be grass? No? It's just a little bit of fear you have in the beginning, but you quickly, learn how to do your proper approaches and landing and stuff. No.
How about your gear check? Like when you go climbing rocks, for instance, you always have a person who's checking your gear. They double check it. Is there someone there on your first flight? There is checking.
Yes. The instructor always checks everything. But of course, he asks you to check it, and he goes with you through every single step. And you just need to, become a normal routine to do it every time.
Right.
You go and fly. You know, that's very important, especially your rescue and on its scene. And then, everything gets hooked properly, and there is nothing poked out or, And then, of course, all your carabiners, they are hooked in properly. And because when you're up in the air, there's no way to fix things anymore. No, because everything has lots of pressure on it. Then
right,
so it would be impossible to fix it.
It's full commitment at that point. When I saw this guy come through here last week, his hands are way up above his shoulders. Is that an awkward position to be flying in? It seems to me your fingers will go to sleep.
No. It's usually with the paramotor. Again, it's very important. It's very important in which way he was strapped in, what kind of harness he has on his motor. He was strapped low or high. You have to kind of adjust for the bottom motor. You have to adjust your lines for the brakes. He has his hands really high because of his brakes. No, they are probably positioned really high, and this can be actually very painful to fly like this for an hour or two. Mm-hmm. It can really hurt. All this stuff comes with experience later, and proper knowledge. That's the most important. I think it's the mm-hmm. proper word to say. Mm-hmm. It's knowledge is very important. Then when you go up in air, you enjoy it, not like a suffer. No,
yeah.
Keeping your hands really up, and it's just it just doesn't make it enjoyable. No.
How about the motor itself? Like, is this something that you maintain yourself, or is this something they?
Yes. When you buy the paramotor, they give you, of course, they give you the manual and everything you have to do every certain hours. No.
Okay.
So it's very important that you actually mount on a motor the hour meter. No, mm-hmm. the RPM meter. Stuff like that.
Right.
Then you exactly know every so many hours you have to check this cruise. You have to tighten certain things. You have to change certain things. You know, it's like everything else, like a car. You know, you have to change oil and stuff. The same thing we have to do with paramotor. You just have to be really cautious. You pre-check all those screws that can be loose, because it happened to me before. Then in the manual say, oh yeah, when you mount this piece, put a red Loctite, and I put the blue one.
Oh yes.
Then came out and it went straight in a prop, and it cost me $500 to replace a prop, you know. And you learn the hard way sometimes, but it's always a lesson, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But usually, you know, we always do the same thing, like pre-flight check on engine too, make sure everything is nice and tight, make sure that all the lines are good, you know, like fuel lines and stuff. And you pre-run it on the ground for so many for a few minutes running, just to heat it up, and after and go to the full throttle, you know, just to feel everything is good, and yeah, and then basically the machine after is good to go, you know?
Yeah. So you're keeping a record of this, obviously. Is this something that has to be filed? Like, I'm just thinking, like NavCan has for airplanes.
No,
nothing like that then.
No, because 99% of people around the world, they don't have a license for it. They don't really require the license for it. You can make one if you want, no problem.
Mm-hmm.
There is no really regulation yet on paramotors, but those things might change in the future. We don't know. But you don't really have to do those things. The only things, if you like, when we have to communicate with the tower, it's only when you're flying around the airspace area. No,
right.
Even with the free flying here in Yukon, we have to, when we fly Heckle Hill, Gray Mountain, we must, or SEMA, we must call in a tower and say, I always call in and say, yeah, I'm a paraglider up in Heckle Hill, and we will be flying for so long, we say it's going to be high or not. And if you do the cross country, it means if the conditions are good, we will fly away. We will let them know, no, because we are in airspace. And they allowed us to do it, no problem. They are very, very, very nice about it. But we have to tell them when we start and when we finish. You know, they actually let other pilots with airplanes know that we are in the area. You know, then it's just a safety thing. You know, and the same thing with the motor too. I go to, let's say I go and launch at Cousins, you know, and I call them in. I tell them I'm at Cousins. I'll be launching my paramotor. And I will tell them what kind of altitude I'll be flying and where I'm flying, and just those, normal things.
Yeah, courtesies, basically.
Yes, but of course, this is also comes with the knowledge too, because you must know the rules, and you have to learn, you know, or you have to ask, you know, around, and then you obey those rules, and yeah.
Because Heckle Hill puts you in front of, well, two airstrips, the one for Whitehorse and Cousins as well, too. So can you, I guess you can pass in front of that, provided they know you're there. But where would that take you to for a landing, though? It doesn't seem like there's a whole lot of options.
Usually, you know, with the motor, you can land anywhere because you have the engine.
Sure.
You can usually, I take off from Cousins and I actually land in the same spot, because we can also fly for a really long time. It depends on how much fuel you can actually carry on your paramotor. But for the free flying, usually we just stay up there and we fly up there. But sometimes it happened, some cross country, and actually the national record in Canada was for a few years here from Heckle Hill all the way to Pelly Crossing. No,
is that right? That's hundreds of kilometers.
Yeah. It was quite incredible. I still can't believe sometimes when I drive up and down and I look all these ridges and mountains across the highway up.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really mountains, I'll say just the higher hills, no. And he made it all the way up there. It's just incredible, you know. You have to be a really, really skilled pilot to know exactly, you know, look down on the ground and say, okay, I might have a thermal here, I have thermal here, and just try to go from one thermal to another one, no, and just fly north. Yeah.
I drove to Pelly Farms last year to go to the open house at Fort Selkirk. And it's about a 6-hour drive, so roughly 600 kilometers.
Mm-hmm.
And that guy did this,
yeah,
like in a paraglider. That's hard to believe, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
What size of motor is the one you use then? It has to be good for fuel consumption. It has a lot of factors involved with that.
Yeah, they're not as fuel efficient as like a four stroke, because most of, like, until now, most of para motors are two stroke. There's actually only one or two. You can get them for four stroke engine. They are quite thirsty, I would say. You know, per hour usually is going to take between, they say, 3.5 to 4.5, but it's not really, it's not exactly like that. It's, I would say, normal consumption, it's about between 4 to 5 liters an hour. No, okay. Depends also on a pilot, what kind of wind you have, and all this stuff, and how you want to fly. My motor is a 185cc, and it's 25 horsepower. I used to have a 200cc with 27 horsepower, but I sold it to a friend of mine, and I decided to go with a different paramotor, the one that can actually fold down much smaller, and that I can actually travel even on my motorcycle too with it. No, mm-hmm. I can put it back, and then I can take him around and stuff. Because for me, all my gear, it's very important that I can pack small as possible. No, then I can take stuff with me. I can go and travel with it, with my equipment. So,
What's your feeling on buying used equipment? Is that something that you would consider?
I actually bought my first paraglider, was used paraglider, and actually was a really bad wing. So overused, porous, but I didn't have any knowledge. I didn't know about it, you know.
Sure.
But today, if I will go and buy used stuff, I will probably buy only from the person that I know and really took care of it, or if somebody really know the motor that was really in a good shape and stuff like that. But myself, I am more towards the new stuff. No, then I start taking care of it from the beginning. Mm-hmm. I know exactly what's on. No, and when I'm up in air, I know that everything's going to be fine. Not, and you just buy it. You don't know what the person did before, and you know, it just dies on you, and you end up, I don't know, landing down somewhere we shouldn't know, and hike, especially here in Yukon, you can hike out in 1 day or 2 days. No, then depends where you fly to. No?
That's right. Yeah. Well, it's like a snowmobile up here. I know a lot of people get into trouble because in 20 minutes you can be further out on a snowmobile than you could ever walk in a day. And the same applies to pretty much any adventure sport out here. It is truly wilderness, and you need to be prepared to spend a night or two at any given moment.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. That's also why I love Yukon. Mm-hmm. Because it's just nature. It's awesome.
It is. It truly is. I know I've seen people with this look in their eyes asking questions to me, like, how far is it to the next town, and how many people live there? And then when you tell them how few people live here and how far it is to the next community, they stand there for a minute thinking about that. Mm-hmm. It's so vast.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Yeah. And that's why people like you and myself and most of the people I talk to on this show, that's why they're here. Like, there's a huge magnet for people that want to truly experience life.
Yes, exactly. I think this is why most of people get stuck here, because they just love nature. It's not for everybody, and this is what I love about it. It doesn't attract everybody, you can't, no. It just attracts those people who loves outdoors and and enjoying this environment.
Mm-hmm. When you hear of a guy doing this flight to Pelly, I mean, that must motivate you. You're an adventurer straight up, like motorcycles, paragliding, whatever it is. What goes through your mind when you hear about a person doing a record like that? Like, what do you want to do now?
No, for me, it's not about doing records and stuff. It's always about experience, you know. Just to, I would love to like fly my paramotor all the way from here to Dawson and stuff like that. You know, like going free flying, and you know, really also pushing the limits. In this way, I don't think so. It's not really something that I'm looking. to do, like with free flying. Even if I personally, I love like push limits, you know, and going dangerous, you know, when there are low temperatures and, you know, when conditions are like more dangerous and stuff. I kind of love those kind of things. Mm-hmm. But there are just certain things that it's not about to make a record. To me, it's just more about to make a really good experience, you know, and see, you know, how my body reacts, how my body takes it, and how my mind works in it. You know, that's the most important part. You know, for myself. You know?
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. If you were say you wanted to do a long adventure to Dawson from here, is there the potential that you can put down here and there and then climb up another mountain and launch yourself again? Is that doable?
With the paramotor, you know, you don't really need the mountain. No, you just fly. You can, I turn off the motor and just use some ridge if there's good wind, or do some ridge soaring and stuff. You actually go scout more places. No, oh, let's just go here. Let's go there. No.
Sure.
Basically, I'll have to go down and refuel and go back up. Even I actually prepare my paramotor to carry more fuel, because I just recently changed a tank from 10 liters to 17, and I built a bleeder that I can put on my laps. Right. And extra 10 liters of gas that I can actually manually put into the tank when I start getting low, and it probably gives me that's 27 liters of fuel, you know, and I would say it gives me approximately 4.5 or maybe pushing 5 hours of flying, you know. Mm-hmm. This is more for like a really big cross country or stuff, you know. Just to be like ready in the spot where you can really not go down and refuel, you know. Or sometimes, you know, you fly in a spot and you're going downwind, but you know that on the way back, you'll work way harder and you'll burn way more fuel, you know.
Right, yeah.
That's why you have to always, you really have to always think about the surrounding and the weather, you know, because it may be also so strong wind that you won't be actually moving at all, you know. Mm-hmm. Those are the things you have to always think about it. No?
So the full package characteristics for someone wanting to do this, I mean, if I'm just looking at you have to be mechanical, you have to be adventurous, you have to be cautious, you have to be very pragmatic, analytical, safe. Like, there's all those things that go into it in order to make this truly a wonderful experience. So, yeah.
Yes. I mean, you don't really have to be a mechanic. It's just that, you know, you just pre-check those things, you know. Even somebody else can do it for you, because I know not everybody can really does mechanic stuff because they just don't understand it. But it's very simple, you know. It's nothing really, it's not a big, it's not a huge knowledge there. You just have to be careful, you know. Mm-hmm. Somebody can do things for them, just pre-check, you know, like engine and stuff. Yeah, you should be good. You know?
Right. I like to ask my guests this wrap-up question, so to speak. I call it the gold nugget of knowledge. If someone approached you and said, hey, Vosgen, I'm interested in what you're doing and how to get involved, what kind of advice would you give to that person? What's your gold nugget of knowledge?
Well, for me, if somebody wants to, like, let's say, start paramotoring, I will definitely recommend to first go and start free flying, learn everything about, you know, nature, get as much as possible knowledge, and then after you can actually be a really good paramotor pilot with really wild knowledge, and you really know what you're doing, because I saw people going even to school for paramotoring and they didn't know lots of things that they can do actually with a paramotor. It's just, you know, I think, knowledge, that's the most important, the very important part. And also, judge the, the weather, if it's not good for you, just don't go. You know, like I said earlier, it's there's always tomorrow. Tomorrow is a new day. It's going to be a better conditions, maybe, or if it's even not tomorrow, after tomorrow, in a week or whatever. No, it's better when it's not for you. You're not safe. You don't feel safe enough. Just don't do it. No, it's just better to better be safe than sorry. You know,
And approach it cautiously, like you said. When you go to your launch, you're thinking through all the things that you've checklisted off. Mm-hmm. Don't be too bold about it, I guess.
Exactly, because it's just better to be, you know, careful, and not going up in the air and have a rodeo, and you know, and just start thinking, oh, I should have stayed down. No, it just make a right call, and that's the really, really important part.
Mm-hmm. If people wanted to see some videos of what you've been doing, is there a website or something you have?
I have my own website from my motorcycle, but I didn't really do much on it for a few years already. I have a few things on. I post few videos and stuff on Facebook, and my Facebook is also open for everybody. It doesn't need to be my friend; they can check stuff on.
Okay.
But I have few videos on YouTube, but I don't really share enough as much as I should. You know, I have lots of videos and lots of photos, but I should actually share them more often.
Well, if you send me some pictures, I'll definitely put them on the website. And also, if you don't mind, I'll put a link to your Facebook page and get people looking at that. Yeah, that'd be great. Because I think you're going to get a lot of interest in this, actually. And, you know, like I said, it's the aviation 100th anniversary here. And what you're doing is unique. So, Well, thanks.
I don't know.
I think it's unique anyway.
Yeah, it's just you know, life choice, and you just do what you have to do, you know. Then, everybody enjoys life differently.
Yeah, well, you're enjoying it to the max, my friend. Good for you.
Mm-hmm. And last winter, I was supposed to do my test run from Prudhoe Bay to Tuck, but because I damaged my lower back. At work, I didn't do it. I couldn't do it because I was recovering a few months.
Right.
Basically, my plan is to cross Arctic from Barrow, Alaska, all the way to Alert on kites and skis. No,
is that right? So you're going to tow like ski pokes behind you then?
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. That's kind of the plan. And basically just use the wind and, of course, you know, walking too, because I'm looking to start my journey. For some reason, I really want to start early in actually 21st of December is on the solstice.
Okay.
This was kind of, it means that I will be, you know, without the sun for at least a month and a half, without any sunshine. But because it's a quite long journey to the north and lots of obstacles and stuff, you know, especially pressure bridges and stuff. Because I'll be quite close to the ground, quite close to the land, you know? But I'll be try to stay further out too, because it's gonna be more smooth ice and stuff, you know. And in just in case if it takes too long, I just want to be able to make it to north, you know. And but yeah.
Wow, is this a solo trip then, or you can take someone else?
Yeah, yeah. I guess I always do solo stuff.
You do.
I actually never, even when I bike with my motorcycle. I went to Tuck three times, one Prudhoe Bay, one to Old Crow. Old Crow took me three times to get to Old Crow, three attempts. And I tried to cross the Hudson Bay from Churchill all the way to up to Arviat, to Nunavut.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't succeed on this one because the conditions were, there was way too much snow on the ocean. No.
Mm-hmm.
It was impossible to cross it. I was just sinking all the time in. And usually, I always do by myself because you know, I don't like to have people whining beside, and right. Everything is good for the first day or second day, you know, and the third day it's, oh, you know, they say, oh, what, I'm doing this, I want to go home, I'm cold, I'm this.
Yeah.
And in your mind, you know, you're focused on some things and you don't want to hear any negative influence, no, to your goal, no. And the only way to keep your focus, what you want to achieve, it's just to, you know, keep your mind sharp to what you want, and not, then nothing can actually put you down. No, this was always for me very important, and I think it's the most important for most of expedition people. They when they go out there to achieve their goal. No,
you are so hardcore, Voschin. you are so hardcore. And that's what you're saying about paragliding too. You know, it's a psychological thing.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. We definitely need some pictures then. And we got to stay connected.
Yeah, no problem. Hopefully, like, cause this winter, the Arctic's going to be still closed, cause right now it's still closed. So
right.
Nobody is allowed to go north, but I'm still hoping that I'll be able to do my test run, and hopefully next year I can do the full trip. You know?
Well, you said you were three times into Old Crow trying to get in there. So it's a small winter road kind of window of opportunity, isn't it? It's not that long.
Yes. Yeah. And even actually when I made it all the way in, it's just because they closed the road already. And because they didn't allow me to pass the half point. No, I was making it good really well. And they decided, one guy saw me and said, no, you have to go back. And then I went back very disappointed. And then one of the truckers that was actually trucking stuff to Old Crow, he told me, if you're really determined, you know, you can make it in, no problem. They didn't blow all the bridges, because usually they use the dynamite to blow all the places where they've been driving over.
Right,
And they made a huge pile in front of the road, and nobody can really go back on it. And he said, if you can make it over, I'm sure you can make it. And yeah, it took me from Eagle Plains to Old Crow, I think about 8 hours, something like this. Oh. It wasn't easy,
no.
But I made it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, please send me some pictures and I'll update that on the Facebook site. And
sounds good.
Also on the My Amazing Yukon Life. So again, thank you, Voschin. You are an icon to me and my friends here who see you riding your motorcycle in the winter and flying around the air. And yeah, excellent. Appreciate your time.
And thank you for having me on it.
My pleasure. Okay. You take care then.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks everyone for dropping by today and picking up your weekly mail. And if you've already subscribed, I'd like to give you a great big thank you, because I'm now looking at 100 subscribers, roughly a little bit more, and about 700 downloads. So the show is starting to pick up some speed, which is fabulous. And I thank you for your support. You hit the subscribe button and it really helps me out. And also, if you happen to have time to leave a small review, I'd appreciate that too. And get in touch with me on the Facebook page on My Amazing Yukon Life Facebook group. And just let me know what you'd like to hear next on the show. If you have some inside info on someone that's of interest to you or some adventure that you've done, and you'd like to share that with me, just reach out, let me know, and I'd be happy to get you on the show. And also, I'll have an update on My Amazing Yukon Life website. I'll include all of the pictures from today's conversation, some links to the Facebook pages for Voschin, and also some of his other motorcycle adventures as well as his paragliding, and what's coming up in the future for him. So in keeping with the 100th anniversary of Yukon Aviation, so glad to have him on the show, and a rare event, like I said before, to get him on a day that isn't a perfect day for going up paragliding, which I'm sure he'll be doing now. And I hope that you found some variety and uniqueness of this podcast, and some humor, some inspiration, and perhaps a little life lesson nugget in the bottom of your gold pan. I'd like to leave you with a quote by Brian Tracy that summarizes today's podcast, and it goes like this. You begin to fly when you let go of self-limiting beliefs and allow your mind and aspirations to rise to greater heights. Until next time, take care and talk to you soon. Cheers.